Last time we went through a chronological order or a sequence of biblical events leading to Satan's influence, influence in a false religion in Babylon. And today we're going to take a little bit closer look at this mystery Babylon religion to understand how it spread throughout the world and to every single religion. And we know that Revelation chapter 17 speaks about this woman that was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Revelation 17 and verse 5 says, "And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth." And we know that the Bible uses symbolic term for woman to symbolize a church. Just as God's church is likened to the bride in Revelation chapter 19, verses 7 and 9, and Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 27, and or the woman that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 12. This woman, Mystery Babylon, is a church as well, or a religion. However, this woman is called a great harlot, who is over kings and kingdoms with many followers, who drinks the blood of the saints of Jesus Christ. This is a false religion against God and his chosen ones. This is a church or religious system that was set up by Satan the devil. Let's see how he accomplishes this. To recap, where we left off about Nimrod, in Genesis chapter 10, it tells us that Nimrod was the son of Cush, who was the son of Ham, the son of Noah. Nimrod became a mighty ruler over the people in the Shinar region, a designation for the land of Babylonia. Shinar was somewhere in Mesopotamia, an area that is now called Iraq in modern times. Shinar means the land of two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. In Hebrew, the word was Shinara. He built cities and formed a state religion, worshiping the sun, moon, planets, himself, and Satan. He was opposed to God and used his power to sway men from following God. And what would become the ancient city of Babylon, he had his followers construct a tower, a huge tower, convinced in his mind that God would not keep his promise of sending another flood or not sending another flood. Now, this building of the tower began after the flood, but it is difficult to tell when it began, when it was being built, when they started building it. But what we can know is when God confused their language. Now, in Genesis chapter 10 and in chapter 11, it tells us a timeline of the occurrences. If you read Genesis chapter 5, Genesis chapter 10, verse 5, 8, 20, and 25, which I'm going to do right now here, you're going to see some of the things that are of how you can put this into a timeline. So starting in Genesis chapter 10, and we'll read first verse 5 first of all. Now verse 5 says, "So From these coastal peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations, according to their language. An interesting term there. Verse 8 says, Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. And we know that. Verse 20 says, and these were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their language, in their lands, and in their nations. And again in verse 25, to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Okay, now, what is this Peleg's division that we're talking about here? Verse 31, it says, and these were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their language, in their lands, according to their nations. Again, it's got this thing about language going on here. Over in Genesis chapter 11, this is continuing on there, and it says, now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed to the east and to land of Shinar, and they dwelt there, and they decided to build this tower. They all had this one language. And of course, we know that God and the Father and Christ, they came down, they looked, and they go like, they're building this tower. What are they going to do next? They're all one language. Whatever they put their minds to, they're going to be able to accomplish and do, and it's going to be just like it was before the flood. So they decided to scramble their languages and gave everybody their own language, which is kind of an interesting thing. But let's get back to this this Peleg's division, and maybe we get some kind of an idea here. Now, in the 1650s, James Usher, he was a Archbishop of Armagh, and he wrote in his chronological work, The Annuals of the Old Testament, the Old and New Testaments. Now, he believed the literal truth of the Bible in assuming that a biblical year would have had, 365 days, which I believe was 360 according to the way the Hebrews kept it, but he was calculating it the way everybody else was at that time, and we still do today. So he dated Noah's flood to about 2349 BC. And then he worked back from there to calculate that God created the world on October, whatever it was, in 4004 BC. Now, he believed that Peleg's division refers to the breaking up of a single landmass after the flood into today's continents. Now, Jewish historian Josephus also speaks about this division around the birth of Peleg. But the Bible science guy, you know who the Bible science guy is? The Bible science guy is William T. Pelletier, PhD, don't want to forget his title. He believes that this context of Peleg's division in Genesis chapter 10 and 11 is a linguistic division, dividing the families into groups according to their tongues. This is what happened at the Tower of Babel. That is why he thinks that Peleg's division is the confusion of the tongues at Babel. If this is so, then the confusion of the language at the Tower of Babel happened 101 years after the flood. When you look at the different dates of the ages, you're able to figure that out. So if the biblical data that we have places the flood, I mentioned this before, this other calculation that seems to be a little bit more on par, the flood being somewhere around 2304 BC, plus or minus 11 years, That would mean the tower event would have happened in 2202 BC, plus or minus 11, 2202. However, there are other dates that they believe the flood occurred, like Bishop Usher, who puts it again like at 2348, making the tower incident 2247 BC. Another date is 2298, therefore the tower would have been 2197. And then there's 2458, making it 2357, and there's 2386, making it 2285. Whatever the date, there's a lot of different dates, and it's all dependent on how people calculate things when you're looking at the information that's in the Bible. But it happened somewhere there in the 2200s or 2300s BC. As mentioned before, we're not sure if his name was truly Nimrod, as this name is descriptive in nature, as it meant the rebel. Well, some believe this Nimrod character could be Gilgamesh or Sargon the Great, as they rose around the same time frame and are credited for the same feats as Nimrod. Many people believe that Nimrod was a real person, and whether or not his name was Nimrod, most importantly is that he did set himself up as a god, or he was set up as a god after he died, and was worshipped as such. One of the main Babylonian gods associated with Nimrod was Bel-Marduk. And we focus on that a little bit later, but we need to look at this Nimrod character just a little bit more closely. Now, I've been doing a lot of research. I got all kinds of books. As you can see, most of them are mythology. Well, mythology, I guess, is a nice way of, they like to sum everything up as mythology, but mythology just basically really is somebody else's religion of old. They actually believe these gods or created these gods. So there's a whole bunch of them here. We'll refer to this book. This one here is an interesting one. It's the Babylonian Genesis by Alexander Hiddil. Got the Babylon religion, mythology, Babylon. The Greeks, they have all kinds of interests and myths, and this is a really nice big one here in the mythology book. It's got everybody in there. A lot of reading. And there's a lot more information online as well. But let's hear again how Josephus explained how Nimrod achieved building this empire of his. Now, it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it were though through his means that they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured the happiness. He also gradually changed government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence upon his own power. He also said that he would have revenge on God, that if he should have the mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach it, and he would avenge himself against God for destroying their forefathers. This is what Josephus wrote. Now, what Josephus says here is precisely what is found in the Gilgamesh epics. Gilgamesh set up a tyranny. He opposed the eternal God and did his utmost to get people to forsake God. According to Alexander Hiddil, in his the Gilgamesh epic, it describes kind of like the first God is dead movement. In the epic, the hero is a vile, filthy, perverted person. Yet he's presented as the greatest and strongest hero that ever lived. Gilgamesh. Now Gilgamesh refers to the eternal God as a monster who sent the flood. So Gilgamesh sets out to find this monster. And he successfully, according to the story, he finds the monster and succeeds in cutting off the head of this creature, according to the story. Now, the name of the monster is Huwawa. It's also Humbaba in Assyrian language. Now, this name is very similar to how God's sacred name was spoken. Yah, you know, the letters YHWH. Now, we know that most people pronounce it Yahweh as a two-syllable word. But what if it was a three-syllable word? Nobody really knows if you're supposed to put just two syllables in there or three syllables. Nobody could really say that. But just think of if you had a three-syllable, it could be Yahweh, almost like Huwawe or Huwawa. I mean, it's very similar in the tongue. But nobody really knows for sure. That's just me with my imagination, I guess. But the thing is this is just another clue that maybe this Gilgamesh could be identified as Nimrod. Again, Nimrod really doesn't show up in history when you look in the history books. I mean, there's a lot of different speculations about this person, but there's nothing found in archaeology or anything else that is close to that. There is a city named Nimrud, which used to be one of the cities that he actually created or established, which was Kahal or Kala. The only reason it was renamed that is because they knew that this city originally was made by him, so they decided to throw that name on there. But anyways, there's this historic king of Uruk. You know, he's mentioned in the stories of Lugabanda and Gilgamesh, of course. But regarding the Sumerian name, now here's another one, Inmerkar. Now, Inmerkar was another one. He was he could be the Nimrod. In Merkar, the suffix kar, it means hunter. It means hunter. So in Merkar is, in fact, Inmer, the hunter. Just as Nimrod was referred to as a mighty hunter in Genesis chapter 10. Furthermore, in Merkar is named as on this Sumerian king list as one who built Uruk. Just as Nimrod is described in Genesis chapter 10, verses 10, having built a kingdom that began in Babel, or Eridu, some people say, and in Erech, E-R-E-C-H, which is also Uruk, U-R-U-K, in the land of Shinar. a lot of crazy information here. Now, after Inmerkar's death, he became honored in the Sumerian myth as a semi-divine hero, Ninutar, something like that. And eventually this cult evolved into the great cult of Marduk, which became the state religion of Babylon after the conquest and religious innovations of Hammurabi. Now, I could keep on going with others that are identified as Nimrod, but I won't. I just wanted you to understand there's many different names and many people that are associated with the rule and establishment of the religious systems. And we know that names were changed due to God's intervention at the Tower of Babel. And Satan, of course, we know is working with many as he does today. Now, according to Alexander Hislop's The Two Babylons, the Tower of Babel was actually the worship of Satan in the form of fire, the sun, and the serpent. However, Satan worship could not be done openly because of the many who still believed in the true God of Noah. So a mystery religion began at Babel where Satan could be worshipped in secret. Now, Hislop's book was aimed at proving that the Roman Catholic Church adopted pagan rituals from the Babylonian mystery religion. The author claims that the Catholic Church, with its popes and sacraments, was founded by the Roman Emperor Constantine in AD 325 as a blend of paganism and Christianity. Now, in 1966, Ralph Woodrow, as a young evangelist, began to preach a mixture of paganism with Christianity, and eventually he wrote a book based on Hislop's titled Mystery Babylon Religion. Later, in the Christian Research Journal, he wrote an article debunking Hislop's book, and therefore his own book. He took it out of print. The article, taken from this article, now this is the actual what he says here. As time went on, I began to hear rumblings that Hislop was not a reliable historian. I heard this from a history teacher and letters from people who heard the perspective expressed on the Bible Answer Man radio program. Good old Hank. Even the Worldwide Church of God began to take a second look at the subject. As a result, I realized I needed to go back through Hislop's work, my basic source, and prayerfully check it out. He went on to replace this book here with the Babylon Connection ? Dismissing all that he agreed on before. He fell to the pressures of organized religion. Now, the full title of Hislop's book, The Two Babylons, it's The Two Babylons, or The Papal Worship Proved to Be the Worship of Nimrod and His Wife. That's the other name to it. Now, Hislop claims that Nimrod and his wife Semiramis ruled over Babylon. Hislop claims that after Nimrod's death, his wife Semiramis lifted him up in memorial as a sun god and by extension deified their son Tammuz as the sun god or the sun reincarnate. And eventually she became to be worshipped herself as a mother goddess. Now one of Mr. Woodrow's arguments against Hislop's The Two Babylons is that he cannot find any definitive proof linking Nimrod and Semiramis in current encyclopedia references. In fact, he says that Nimrod and Semiramis, according to these references, did not even live in the same centuries. While it is true that there are several different modern encyclopedias that do not link these names together, there are several ancient writers that do. Take, for example, the following as written by Augustine of Hippo. And he wrote this, Augustine, he lived somewhere between 354 and 395 A.D. He echoes the historian Eusebius and others. Okay, now in Augustine's book, The City of God, he says that Ninus, N-I-N-U-S, then who succeeded his father Belus, the first king of Assyria, was already the second king of that kingdom when Abraham was born around 1996 B.C. in the land of the Chaldees. He is reported to have subdued the whole of Asia, even the boundaries of Libya. The Indians in the eastern regions were the only people whom he did not reign. But after his death, Semiramis, his wife, made war on them. Thus, it came to pass that all the people and the kings of those countries were subject to the kingdom and authority of the Assyrians and did whatever they were commanded. Now, Abraham was born in that kingdom among the Chaldees in the time of Ninus. Now, Ninus in Greek mythology is the king of Assyria, and and founder of the city of Nineveh, which is also sometimes called Ninus. It was said that he had been the son of Belos, or Bel, and they have conquered at least 17 years all of Western Asia with the help of Arius, the king of Arabia. During the siege of Bactra, that's where he met Semiramis, his wife. She was the wife of one of his officers, Onis, and he took her from Onis and married her. The fruit of their marriage was Ninus, the Ninevite. Now, Ninus, that's spelled N-I-N-Y-A-S. Now, the amazing Bible timeline with world history, it mentions this. The names of King Ninus and his wife, Queen Semiramis, were first mentioned in the historical account of Assyria written by Titius of Cnidus, who asserted to have gained the knowledge from the court physician of Artaxerxes II. Now, King Ninus is further mentioned in European historians all the way up to the 19th century and all their different books. Now, King Ninus was first associated with the biblical mighty warrior Nimrod in the Clementine literature entitled Recognitions. Now, Clement, he was a bishop of Rome near the end of the first century. Now, Archbishop Usher, which I mentioned before, also speaks of Ninus and Semiramis as founding the Assyrian Empire, but he has them doing it somewhere around 1267 BC. Now, Justin, his real name is Marcus Junius Justinus. Just call him Justin, that is. He flourished around the 3rd century AD, and he was a Roman historian. And he writes of Ninus from Pompeius Trogus's lost works, and also speaks of Semiramis saying this, that she built Babylon and walled around it bricks laying the stones with brimstone instead of sand. This brimstone erupted naturally from the earth everywhere around that area. This queen did many other memorable acts. Not content to keep her husband's conquest, she added Ethiopia to her dominions, and she also made war on India. She was one of the first to enter India, and Alexander the Great was, of course, the next. Now, Diodorus Siculus, he was a 1st century BC Greek historian from Agrarium, Sicily. And in his second book, the Bibliotheca, I'm having fun with the words today. It states that Semiramis reigned for about 42 years over all of Asia, except for India, and lived to be 62 years old. Now, Martin J. Collins, he refers to this Semiramis, the queen regent of Assyrian Empire, which reigned from 811 to 806 BC. Now we're getting closer here. Now, they say that this Semiramis was more famously known as Semiramis. She held the throne for her son, Adad-nirari III, until he reached maturity. Now, she was the wife of Shamshi-Adad V, who reigned between 823 and 811 BC. And when he died, she assumed the rule until Adad-nirari III came of age, which at that time she passed the throne to him. And according to the historian Gwendolyn Lick, this woman achieved remarkable fame and power in her lifetime and beyond. According to the contemporary records, she had considerable influence at the Assyrian court. This would explain how she was able to maintain the throne after her husband's death. Women were not admitted to positions of authority in the Assyrian Empire. And to have a woman ruler would have been unthinkable unless that particular woman had enough power to take it and hold it. Apparently she did. There are many other tales about Semiramis. At times, it is difficult to determine whether or not this is the same person or different people with the same name. It really gets confusing. One of Semiramis's great feats, along with her son, was in promoting the worship of Bel Marduk. Again, we're back to Bel Marduk. In these tales, Adad-nirari III, or Ninus, even Tammuz, see, they're incorporating all these other names. The Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, it talks about this Tammuz, who was supposed to be, in, according to Hyslop's story, Semiramis and Nimrod's son, Tammuz. Now, Tammuz was the Sumerian Dumuzi in the Mesopotamia religion, the god of fertility, embodying the powers of new life and nature in the spring. The earliest known mention of Tammuz in the text, dating to the early parts of the early dynastic, the third period, which is between 2600 to 2334 BC. But his cult was probably much older than that. Now, Tammuz began as a Sumerian shepherd named Dumuzi or Dumuzid, and his father was a Mesopotamian god, Enki, also known as the Akkadian and Babylonian A, which is EA. That's how you spell that one. Who saved the family of Utnapishtim, which is their Noah from the Gilgamesh tales. And his mother was the sheep goddess Duter. In the early Sumerian culture, Tammuz was the god of sheep, lambs, and sheep's milk. He was a pastoral deity. And in later Akkadian myths, he became the god of agriculture. And as we see in the story, Dumuzi was to spend 6 months of the year in the underworld, and it was believed that it was the tears shed by the vegetation god that brought the rains. So during the wetter months, the god was in heavens. However, during the hotter months of the summer, when the rain stopped, this is when the vegetation god Tammuz was in the underworld. This theme continues on throughout mythology. An important part of the myth regarding Tammuz is his death at the hand of his lover, the goddess of love, Inanna. Now, Inanna, according to she ordered the people to weep for Dumuzi. The people would symbolically weep for Dumuzi or Tammuz, as in weep for instead of him. Now, we see this in the Bible, the weeping for Tammuz. Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8 and verse 12. Ezekiel chapter 8, starting in verse 12, it says, "Then he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the room of his idols? For they say, the Eternal does not see us, the Eternal has forsaken the land. And he said to me, turn again, and you will see greater abominations that they are doing." So he's talking about the people that were still in Jerusalem. They're worshiping idols and other gods. Verse 14. "So he brought me to the door of the north gate in the Eternal's house. And to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again. You will see greater abominations than these. So he brought me into the inner court in the Eternal's house, and there at the door of the temple of the Eternal between the porch and the altar, there was about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Eternal, and their faces toward the east. And they were worshiping the sun towards the east. All this having to do with sun worship. The women are weeping for Tammuz. They were worshiping foreign gods. This weeping for Tammuz, unlike the claimed 40 days, lasted anywhere between 40 hours to 6 weeks. The act showed that there was people that accepted other gods and were performing rituals that the pagans did. Now, there are numerous tales about Tammuz's lover, wife, Inanna, going to the underworld to bring him back. In Babylonia, the month Tammuz was established in the honor of the eponymous god Tammuz, who originated as the Sumerian shepherd god Dammuzi, the consort of Inanna, the Akkadian Ishtar. Unfortunately, the Jews in captivity adopted this month of Tammuz for themselves in their Jewish calendar. This was a month that they honored in Babylon. And when they were there captive, when they came back, they brought that month with them. And it's still in their calendar today is Tammuz. Okay, so there was a Tammuz and there was a Semiramis. Now Hislop, he tries to connect the two in a mother-son relationship, and even a son who marries his mother to fit the Tammuz and Inanna or Ishtar relationship. But once again, where is Nimrod in this story? Now, Greek historian Herodotus, who lived between 484 and 425 BC, reported seeing in Babylon what he believed were the remains of Nimrod's Tower of Babel. But he probably saw instead a ziggurat that Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt over the ruins of the one that was there. And he did that, of course, in the middle of the second millennium BC. Now, the ziggurat was dedicated to Marduk, the chief god of the Babylonians. No doubt that Nimrod's Tower of Babel inspired the original ziggurat that Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt. As the founder of Babel in Shinar, Nimrod was probably one who eventually was deified to become Merodach or Marduk. Now, Merodach is the one that's mentioned in the Bible. Now, Marduk was the patron god of Babylon, the Babylonian king of the gods who presided over justice, compassion, healing, regeneration, magic, and fairness, although he is sometimes referenced as the storm god and an agricultural deity. The Greeks associated with him with Zeus, and the Romans with Jupiter. He is depicted as a human in royal robes carrying a snake dragon and a spade. Now, Marduk's name is linked to Maru, which translates to bull calf, although he was commonly referred to simply as Bel, B-E-L, or Lord. Bel Marduk would become the most prestigious god of the Mesopotamia pantheon. Other names were Merodach, which was the biblical Hebrew, and Mardoshius, which was Greek, and of course Bel, which means Lord. And an interesting thing about that is, and I discovered a lot when the Persian language, it was also Bel in the Persian language. Now the Persian language actually ended up in Britain as part of their language when they were doing things. So it's interesting that that it came time to worship at the temple of Bel Mardu. They would let everybody know, they would ring an instrument to let everybody know that it was time to come worship up at the temple of Bel Marduk. Eventually, the name of the instrument just became known as the bell. And it's interesting that the bell is still used today to bring people to worship Bel Marduk. Now, Bel became the Semitic word Baal. Bel and Baal is the same thing, B-A-A-L. Because Baal means Lord too, just like Bel means Lord. Now he was the son of the god of wisdom, Enki, known as A, considered the creator god in some myths, who was also associated with fresh, life-given water. There's so many things that you can see in here where Satan, along the way, can continually try to mimic everything that God was doing, setting up this counterfeit thing because he knew God's plan. You got to keep that in mind. Satan knew God's plan. He knew a lot of things. He set up these counterfeit things to mirror so that people would doubt, you know, Christianity today. Now, Marduk's wife was the fertility goddess Sarpennetu, also identified as Ura or Ura, E-R-U. You figure out how to pronounce it. And she was a Babylonian pregnancy god. And it was known in the European magical clans of hereditary occultism. And her son was Nabu, N-A-B-U, the patron god of the scribes, literally, in literacy and in wisdom. Now, Bel Marduk and Nabu, or sometimes it's pronounced Nebu, E-N-B-O, is mentioned in the Bible. Isaiah chapter 46. Isaiah chapter 46 and verse 1. It says, Bel bows down, Nebu stoops. Their idols were on the beast and on the cattle. Your carriages were heavily loaded, a burden to the weary beast. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 2. Declare among the nations, proclaim and set up a standard, proclaim and do not conceal it. Say, Babylon is taken, Bel is shamed, Merodach is broken in pieces, her idols are humiliated, her images are broken in pieces. Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 44. I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will bring out of his mouth what he has swallowed, and the nations shall not stream to him anymore. Yes, the wall of Babylon shall fall. Now, Bel Marduk was a very important god, and one that Nebuchadnezzar worshipped. And his name actually, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's name actually means Nebo protect the crown, Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, who was the last Babylonian king who saw the writing on the wall, remember that guy? His name was Belshazzar, which means Bel protect the king. Again, they incorporated these names into the kings and the cities as well. Now Nebuchadnezzar, as we know from scripture, also he changed Daniel and his three friends' names to take away their allegiance from the God of Israel and to give allegiance to the Babylonian gods as follows. Daniel actually means God is my judge. Well, they changed that to Belteshazzar, may Bel protect his life. And Hananiah, it meant God is gracious. Well, they changed his name to Shadrach, meaning command of Aku, after a Babylonian moon god, Era Aku. Now, Mishael, it meant who is like God. They changed it to Meshach. Now, Meshach means belonging to Aku, again, after this Babylonian moon god, Aku. Now, Azariah, that meant God helps. They changed that to Abednego. And sometimes it's actually Nebo, which meant servant of Nebo, the Babylonian god of wisdom. Nebo, Marduk's son. From a regional agricultural deity, Bel Marduk took on increasingly significant And then it's for the city of Babylon, and later the Assyrian and Neo-Assyrian Empire, becoming finally the most important and the most powerful of all the gods in Babylonia and the wider Mesopotamia pantheon, and attaining the level of worship bordering on monotheism. He was regarded as the creator of the heavens and the earth, and co-creator with Enki of human beings, therefore rivaling the eternal God, which is why he's mentioned in the Bible. Marduk's star was Jupiter. And his sacred animals were horses, dogs, and especially the so-called dragon with the forked tongue, the Bushusu, or the snake dragon. It's represented on the walls of the city of Babylon. We saw that when we were over there in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. The long dragon-like thing with the forked tongue. That was one of his symbols of Marduk. Now, the kings of Assyria and Persia also honored Marduk, and Sarpennatu, his wife. There is inscriptions and many temples with their names on it. Now, the Babylonian mythology, Sarpennatu or Sarpennet, there's a couple different pronunciations. Some starts with a Z and some starts with an S. She's a mother goddess and a consort of the chief god Marduk. Her name means shining one, the shining one, and she is sometimes associated with the planet Venus. She was worshipped via the moon rising and was often depicted as being pregnant. She was a rival to Ishtar, or Eanu, who was actually Marduk's betrothed half-sister. Yeah, it gets crazy. Ishtar, spelled I-S-H-T-A-R, is the Assyrian and Babylonian counterpart to the Sumerian Inanna and the Semitic goddess Astarte. Now, Ishtar is the goddess of fertility, love, war, and sex, and was divine personification of the planet Venus. In the Babylonian pantheon, she was supposed to marry her brother, her half-brother Marduk, yet she still rose to become known as the Queen of Heaven. The Queen of Heaven. Ishtar was above all associated with sexuality. Her cult involved sacred prostitution. Her holy city of Uruk was called the town of the sacred courtesans, and she herself was the courtesan of the gods. Iana, the Sumerian goddess of sexual love, also known as Astarte or Ishtar, in the Sumerian and Assyrian iteration, Tammuz, remember Tammuz? He was incorporated into the Hellenic pantheon as Adonis, the beautiful youth who earned the love of Aphrodite. Now, like Ishtar, the Greek Aphrodite in the northwestern Semitic Astarte were love goddesses who were as cruel as they were wayward. Now, Donald A. McKenzie, an early popularizer of mythology, he draws a parallel between the love goddess Aphrodite and her dying god lover, Adonis, on one hand, and the love of the goddess Ishtar and her dying god lover, Tammuz, on the other hand. Joseph Campbell, a more recent popularizer of mythology, equates Ishtar with Inanna and Aphrodite, and he also draws a parallel between the Egyptian goddess Isis, who nurses Horus, and the Babylonian goddess Ishtar, who nurses the god Tammuz. Now, Astarte was the Greek name of the goddess known throughout the Eastern Mediterranean from the Bronze Age to the Classical times. Originally deified as the evening star, she is identified as the Phoenician Ashtart and the Hebrew Ashtoreth, or Ashtoreth in the singular form, or Ashtarot in the plural, and appears in the Akkadian as the goddess Ishtar. They're all the same people. The name also appears in the extrusion, you know, or Etruscan as Una Aste, or Ishtar, or Ashtar. Now, Astarte was connected with fertility, sexuality, and war. Her symbols were the lion, the horse, the sphinx, the dove, and a star within a circle indicating the planet Venus. Pictorial presentations often show her naked. Astarte was accepted by the Greeks under the name Aphrodite. Now, we can see there's a pattern here where the gods worship by different nations, by different names, and they're kind of all connected. Now, Hyslop's To Babylon says the same thing, and he is correct, unlike Woodrow and others have said, you know, he didn't get those things wrong. Now, Hyslop may have exaggerated the story of Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz, kind of putting them all together because of the different similarities. But he was just doing all this to promote his agenda, which was what he was trying to do. But it might not be historically correct. I'm trying to set the historical record straight from the information we got. You can take that and decide for yourself. What we do know is Satan convinced mankind to worship the sun, the moon, and the planets, as well as other things in nature. Let's take a look at the sun gods real quick. Bel-Marduk, of course, was definitely one of the sun gods worship. In Arabian mythology is Melek Bel. There are five Aztec sun gods, one being... I put this here because I wanted to really try to see if I can pronounce this. The Aztec names are really fun to do. Hetzuapoktil. Yeah, okay. I totally butchered that. The Egyptian mythology has quite a few of them too, like Bast. Bast was a cat goddess associated with the sun. Of course, there's Horus, the god of the sky, whose right eye was considered to be the sun and his left eye was considered to be the moon. And then there's Amun and Atum and Aten and Pot and Nefertum and, of course, Ra. Germanic mythology, it's Sol, S-O-L, Sol, or Suna, which is also the Roman sun god, too, and a Norse goddess of the sun. Not to be outdone, the Greeks have about eight sun gods, like Electrana, the goddess of the sun, morning and waking up. Apollo and Helios are just a couple of the others. There's a whole lot more. In Hinduism, you got Surya, and other Indian gods include Riva and Saranu, and an Indo-Persian god of the sun is Mitra or Mitras. Mithra. There's a couple of different pronunciations, and depending on if you throw the H in there or not. God of honesty, friendship, contracts, meetings, and the morning sun. The Hittite was Arena goddess, and then there was the Stanu. And the Incas had a, you know, Inti, the god of sun, and patron deity of the Incas. They're all over the place. The Japanese, it was Amaterasu, or Amaterasu, Rusu. Forget about it. She was the goddess of the sun. There's a lot of moon gods, too. You know, Carthagen, one we're going to speak about, is the Baal Hamun. Mesopotamia, Sin. Sin was a goddess. Or Eru Aku, which I mentioned before. The Arabian was Talib. Minyan was Wad. Canaanite, Uruk. Greek, you had Artemis, and Roman was Diana. There's a lot of fertility gods and goddesses. Adonis was one of them. You know, Tammuz was another one. I mean, this list goes on and on. There's just so many of these different things. You got the Roman Sibyl. In the Teutonic or the Norse gods, you got Frigg, which was Odin's wife. She was the one to protect the marriages. In Hawaii, Haumei, the goddess of childbirth in the Hawaiian mythology. One of her children was the volcano and fire goddess Pele. Her children also include the sea goddess Namaka and Haiaka, the goddess of hula dancers. You got to know that stuff. Humu was said to be continually reborn, therefore allowing her to continually mate with her offspring. Of course, Anu is there, Ishtar, Juno in Rome. They're all different fertility gods. It keeps on going on. Even Marduk became a fertility god. And Baal, or Bel. And then Mithras, of course, from the old Iranian area, a Persian god that the cult flourished throughout the Roman Empire from about 50 AD. Osiris, an Egyptian, was an Egyptian fertility god. Osiris also a god of reincarnation and fertility. And his wife, Isis, basically reconstructed his dead body after it was dismembered by his evil brother Set. But Isis reanimated the body long enough to become pregnant with Horus. I kid you not, these are the stories. Mythology. You know, you have Pan, the Greek god of nature. Tammuz, again. Aphrodite. The list goes on. Every nation, every tribe, every peoples have their own set of gods that they worshipped in their particular religion. Satan has satisfied their needs and set himself up as their God. After all, he is the God of this world. Next, we will see these systems of God and the goddesses that became Mystery Babylon the Great.